first. They tortured the radicals.
It really was no-touch torture. It was psychological torture. It was an experiment. And we knew at the time that if they succeeded in doing this to us, then it would proliferate throughout the system. And it has.
That's Susan Rosenberg. We spend most of the hour talking with her about her prison memoir, An American Radical, A Political Prisoner in My Own Country. And later, we remembered Nobel Peace Prize winner Wangari Maathai. She died September 25th after a long battle with cancer. I'm Francesca Rhiannon, and this is Writer's Voice. Many Americans would be surprised to find out that we have political prisoners in the U.S., but we do. When I first got the press release about Susan Rosenberg's prison memoir, American Radical, I noticed that she'd been in the notorious experimental prison in Lexington, Kentucky, where an old friend of mine, Sylvia Baraldini, was incarcerated for many years. I had known Sylvia back in Madison, Wisconsin, during the anti-war movement of the 1960s. Much later, when Sylvia was sentenced to 43 years in prison for her activities supporting radical black liberationists, I was shocked at the severity of her sentence. I had known her as a kind and caring individual, and I couldn't imagine her doing something that would bring that kind of punishment. Later, I was even more shocked to hear of the harsh treatment she endured in the high-security unit at Lexington. The five women inmates at the unit, all political activists, were isolated in a windowless concrete building, subjected to sleep deprivation and harassment, with bright fluorescent lighting and surveillance 24 hours a day. They were often shackled and strip-searched, and repeatedly told that the only way they could leave the unit was if they renounced their political beliefs. Like my guest today, Susan Rosenberg, Sylvia never harmed or killed anyone. I'm not excusing the crimes for which both women were convicted, and neither does Susan Rosenberg in her book American Radical. But what comes clear in reading Rosenberg's eloquent and moving memoir is that she, Sylvia, and other leftist radicals were given excessively long sentences and subjected to inhumane conditions because of their political views. What's even more shocking is that the harsh conditions they were subjected to had become common throughout the prison system, and the degradation and humiliation of prisoners, especially women, is tantamount to policy in the U.S. prison system, where rehabilitation has fallen by the wayside and only draconian punishment remains. Susan Rosenberg bucked this trend by fighting for and securing her MFA in writing in prison, and she went on to win 4 Penn Awards while still incarcerated. Rosenberg lives and works now in New York City. I sat down with her at her home to talk with her about her book, American Radical. Susan Rosenberg, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you very much.
Now, before we get into talking about your wonderful book, would you read a section for us?
Yes. This book is about American prisons and my experience of over 16 years in various American prisons. And this is a brief part from the Washington, D.C. jail. One night, after many days of overcrowding and out-of-control tempers, there was a shakedown. We heard the correctional officers, COs, all 20 of them, marching down the hall leading to the block. Of all the conditions in the jail, the shakedowns were the most invasive, the most enraging, and the most irrational. Of course there were drugs. Dope hit the unit every week. Of course people made weapons. Of course there was contraband food from the kitchen. We watched the cops sell dope, and a weapon could be fashioned from an aluminum can from the commissary. The COs would come suited up in combat gear. Each cell was hit one by one, and mine was always first. Having heard them well in advance of their actual arrival, I had already flushed my contraband coffee grinds, my big illegal item. "Step out," they ordered. I was handcuffed and told spread. This meant facing the wall and stretching out my arms and legs. I was patted down and told to stand next to the door. Four of them went in. They searched every single thing. They unscrewed the light bulb. They climbed on the top bunk and looked at the windowsill. And they went through every legal and personal paper one by one. They dragged the mattress onto the tier. They took shampoo and talcum powder and poured them out onto the mattress. They took scooped peanut butter from an old jar and smeared it on my personal photographs. They uncuffed me, put me back inside, shut the door, and repeated the process in every cell down the line. Everyone was yelling. In the cells that hadn't been hit yet, women were standing and watching. The violence seemed to increase with each cell. And then they got to the last three cells. They popped open the door and one of them roared, "Step out!" The woman inside was brushing her teeth. One of them stepped in and grabbed her. She spit out her mouthful of toothpaste and saliva on him. If they had waited 10 seconds, she would have stepped out on her own. But she was disobeying an order. So four of them began to beat her up, with all the rest of us watching. The small woman fought back. Everyone was hollering and throwing things out of their windows. An egg went flying and hit one of the guards. Four of them dragged the woman up the stairs and into the entrance to the block. The cops had bloodlust in their eyes. In the hall, they couldn't get the cuffs onto her. Her fury matched theirs. Eventually, they overpowered her and carried her off. I had never before seen that level of brutality directed against a woman. We were all crying from anger, frustration, and fear, and yet in the D.C. jail, it was almost normal. It was not extreme, a little more brutal than usual, but only a little. To administer by fear and control, by terror, was a tactic that was understood by the prisoners. It was a natural way of life, inside or outside. And I cried because I didn't know how to resist that level of dehumanization. Amid the wreckage of my cell, I spotted a book of poetry on the floor. I found the well-known poem by Langston Hughes, Harlem, the one that begins, "What happens to a dream deferred?" I stood at my window, and in the pulsating silence in the aftermath of what we had just been through, I read it at the top of my lungs. No one said anything. And then a single voice started singing Amazing Grace, and then another and another, until there were many voices. Everyone knew the words. It was a most beautiful rendition, the richest I had ever heard. And as the sound rose and fell, I remembered hearing somewhere that that song had been written by a slaver, a ship captain who experienced a dramatic conversion and later spoke out strongly against slavery. I once was lost, but now am found.
Thank you so much. I mean, that's such a powerful passage, and it really encapsulates so much of what your book is about. Struggle, resistance, oppression, and poetry, writing. How did you find yourself in the Washington jail?
Well, I was part of the radical student movement in the late 1960s and 70s. I was part of the group of people that was militantly against the war in Vietnam and ended up on a path, a radical path that took me into joining an illegal armed organization in the 1970s and early 1980s, and ended up being arrested with explosives in 1984 and being sentenced to 58 years in federal prison. And I ended up being in a number of prisons over the course of my time, but part of that time was in pretrial detention in the District of Columbia jail, which was a very different kind of jail and prison experience than most of the time that I did, which was in the federal system and under very severe, extreme conditions of maximum security and isolation.
You were arrested because you had explosives. Was anybody hurt during the commission of your crime?
Well, my crime was possession of weapons and explosives and false ID. That was my conviction. And no, nobody was hurt.
So in your book, American Radical, you point out that the longest previous sentence for possession of explosives previous to your own sentencing was a maximum of 5 years. You were sentenced to 58. Why this discrepancy?
I think the discrepancy was because of the politics of who we were and what we believed. And I think that the sentence length was really to teach a lesson to people. There was a very small but very important political movement, the sanctuary movement that was going on at the time. There was still remnants and movements within the black movement and other national movements in the United States. And I think we were, you know, out of place in terms of time, but we had very strong beliefs about what the United States was responsible for. And I think it was to teach a lesson.
The sanctuary movement?
The sanctuary movement was a movement that took people who were victims of repression in Central America as a result of the civil wars that were going on at the time and were trying to get immigration status in the United States and were denied. And so there grew up a movement of people who gave sanctuary and safe harbor to political people who were trying to come into the United States.
Now, this is not an isolated case, this extremely long sentence. It seems that that's the norm, not only then, but even now. I think a lot of people might be surprised to learn that there are political prisoners in the United States. Could you talk a little bit about, you know, what's this all about?
Yeah, the title of my book is A Political Prisoner in My Own Country, and I think that there are political prisoners in the United States, and there are over 100 political prisoners who are from the period of the 60s and 70s and 80s. And now there is, as you mentioned, a new wave of political repression going on against animal rights activists and environmental rights activists. And most, I think, significantly in terms of the politics of the moment are Muslim folk who are being labeled terrorists and sent into maximum security prisons in the U.S. and in detention. And so I think, though, that there's this country is, you know, says that we are the greatest country with democratic and human rights. And so it's very important for the United States to deny that there was political opposition and that there was a political and radical movement and that there was a political police, that the state actually waged a war against the radical movement in this country in the 60s. It was in different forms. One form that it took was the counterintelligence program, where the FBI infiltrated movements and tried to destroy movements, in particular the black movement and the Puerto Rican independence movement and the American Indian movement. But across the board, the FBI was really trying to stop the left from organizing and from having an impact on American society. So out of that came people who resisted and went to prison for it. And, you know, there are different people in doing time now for different kinds of offenses, but they were motivated out of their political beliefs. And I think, you know, the world definition of political prisoner is a prisoner of conscience. That's kind of become the accepted international human rights definition. And there are political prisoners of conscience in the United States. Some of the people who are facing death on death row are prisoners of conscience. But there's also another definition, which is politically motivated, criminally convicted. And I fall into that definition, as do many other people who are currently facing life until death in prison for the past.
We're talking with Susan Rosenberg about her book, American Radical. Now, I have to ask this. If you were carrying explosives, one would assume you intended at some point to use them. So could you give us a little bit more of that context?
What we believed, my colleagues and comrades and people I was associated with, believed that we needed to physically stop the war machine, that we had to take responsibility as Americans to prevent our government from acting in ways that it was. And so for us, that meant bombing buildings that were part of the government, that were government buildings or military institutions or targets. And I think corporate and industrial, the military-industrial complex. And we thought at the time, and I think we were wrong in many ways, but we thought at the time that in order to build a revolutionary movement, we had to have the capacity to organize people away, separate from the public eye, in order to be effective. And we hoped that if we did some of these kind of actions, it would spark activism. And we, I think, were doing this and thinking this in a period where that was absolutely not going to happen. And that became really obvious. But it wasn't obvious at the time to us. You know, Reagan had just been elected president in 1980. And I think I certainly feel I read the conditions in the country completely through my own very committed and very rigid eyes.
Mm-hmm. And you were about 25 years old.
I was 28.
Now, talk about your trial. You describe it as a venomous and hostile drama.
Our trial was very much an antagonistic and terrible experience, I think, all around. Our judge really, you know, in sort of a vernacular, threw the book at us. And we took the position that we were not criminals, that we were acting out of conscience against criminal violations by our government. And that really just, you know, set the tone. We fired our lawyers the day the trial began. We represented ourselves. And we tried to make a necessity defense argument, which the judge was just enraged at, that we would do that. And, you know, he basically said we needed to read The God That Failed because we were really misguided in all of our beliefs, and that as we were, you know, the most dangerous people who had ever been in his courtroom, which was, of course, not true. But I think, you know, we played our part. I certainly played my own part in raising the stakes in that trial, and it you know, really played itself out in then how we were sentenced. At the time, our lawyers, who were our legal representatives, but we were representing ourselves when the trial was over, and we were waiting for the jury to come back, our lawyers said, well, you know, we think you'll get 15 years. And I thought we're going to get the maximum sentence we could possibly get. And initially the judge tried to give us 106 years, but couldn't because it was actually double sentencing. And so he had to cut it to 58. But that was very clear to me that that was what was going to be the outcome of our trial.
How did you raise the stakes?
I think by saying that we were not criminals, and that we were, there was no criminal action, and that we were motivated out of politics. And, you know, that is a complicated argument to make when you have possession of weapons. So, I mean, I think in retrospect, that became clear to me at the time. You know, I was very caught up in what I believed very, very, very deeply.
So you went to a prison in Tucson first, and I was really struck by what happened when you left there. You were basically raped.
Yeah, that's true. I think my experience in the prison system was consistently being treated with extreme measures, extremely harsh measures. And the prison there was sending me to an experimental prison unit in Lexington, Kentucky. And I was the first woman prisoner, along with another political prisoner, a Puerto Rican independentista. We were together, and they were sending us to this experimental prison. And I think they decided that they were going to really repress us as much as they could and attack us in our own humanity. So they did a forced cavity and rectal search, and terrible, terrible violence against us.
So you went to this experimental prison in Lexington, Kentucky. You were there also with somebody that I knew in my past, Sylvia Baraldini. I remember I had known her in Madison, Wisconsin, and I have to say she was one of the nicest people that I've ever known. And I had no idea just how terrible were the conditions until many years later I heard that, you know, it was basically torture. So talk to us about this experimental prison and what was in a model for?
The Lexington High Security Unit was a small group isolation unit that was built in the basement of a larger prison. And the conditions there were lights on all the time, cameras everywhere, blinding white, no real contact, no contact with other prisoners ever. Our mail was censored, our visits were censored, our movement was really censored. In order to leave the cells that we were in, we were handcuffed and leg cuffed and escorted, three-man escort, sometimes not always three-man. And it was designed to break our will in this isolation, this small group isolation. And this was going on in other countries at the same time, against the Irish prisoners in Ireland, against the Italian prisoners in Italy, against the German prisoners, who were all part of revolutionary and armed movements in those countries. And it was designed to drive us to commit suicide. And that's really what was found when the movement was successful in forcing a spotlight onto the conditions that we were in, and the American Civil Liberties Union and the National Prison Project of the ACLU and the United Church of Christ and the out-of-control lesbian political prisoner support group and all kinds of different groups united to build a campaign to expose the conditions in this high security unit. I think one of the things that happened that I talk about in my book, and I think it is important then and also now, but one of the things that happened was that the prison authorities there, after we'd been there for a period of time, said to us, if you renounce your political beliefs, you'll be able to move into general population, and we will take you out of these severe and onerous conditions. So it became clear that was the reason that we were there. And ultimately, we sued the government on First Amendment violations because our belief, and my belief, was that we were put there because of our politics and because of who we were, not because of actions that had occurred in the prison, which up until then, people who went into maximum security, or what's commonly known as the hole, committed violations inside the prison. You know, your prison sentence was the punishment, not the punishment on top of the punishment. So, and we sued on First and Eighth Amendment grounds, and we won the case on First Amendment grounds. The judge in the case was a really interesting judge, Barrington Parker, and he did not rule that it was cruel and unusual punishment and torture as we brought to the court, but he said in the decision that he wrote that this was close to the most vile conditions that he had ever seen. and closed that unit, like, forthwith, I mean, immediately. So I think what's important about the experience, and I'm happy that I can talk about it now, is that it really was no-touch torture. It was psychological torture. It was an experiment. And we knew at the time that if they succeeded in doing this to us, then it would proliferate throughout the system. And it has. And I think that there's an important connection between what happened to us and what is happening in Guantanamo now and in other places, not just Guantanamo, but very much the ADXs, the maximum security conditions in Florence, Colorado, and in Florida, in different federal centers where people who are both political and high profile are sent into these conditions, which are torture. And it's standard operating procedure.
What you're talking about, the bright lights, the loud music, the sensory deprivation, is what is going on in the so-called SEER program, you know, the program of the U.S. military to use these kinds of methods to break prisoners, as you say, in Guantanamo and other places. So how did it happen that you were able to win a case to close down Lexington, Kentucky, and yet this model went on to proliferate?
Well, I think, you know, what happened in the courts was that that opinion and that decision was overturned on appeal. And what the end result of that whole litigation was, and I don't think people really know this or understand this about the Bureau of Prisons and the U.S. Justice Department currently, have the sole authority to determine where a prisoner is for how long a prisoner is there, and there's under all conditions which are acceptable, and there is no recourse or due process for prisoners. And I think that that is part of the reason it could proliferate in the way it has. I think there's other issues that have to do with the war on terror and what are acceptable tactics. One thing I feel strongly about is that as long as the death penalty is acceptable in our country and our country supports the use of the death penalty, which it does, then any other treatment is acceptable. Anything is okay because it is not the death penalty. So torture is okay. And spending 20 years in maximum security and isolation from other prisoners is okay because it's, you know, it's justified. So I think there's a correlation between the death penalty and the use of torture and suppression of political opposition.
Just not to belabor the point too much, but it really struck me in reading your book, Susan Rosenberg, An American Radical, put me in mind of Abu Ghraib. And the thought, again, that of what I knew, which is that Charles Grainer, who was one of the people there, you know, kind of the ringleader of that group of guards who were involved with the abuses, was in fact, before he went into the army, into the armed forces, he was a prison guard. And I remember reading somewhere the comment that, well, you know, what he had done in Abu Ghraib was no different than the conditions that obtain in every American prison.
I think that's true. And I think that that's part of why I wrote the book, was to shed light on how extreme the conditions really are in American prisons and what happens to people inside of them. And I read that too. And, you know, I think that people become acclimated and accustomed to torture. So I think that he was not the only one.
Now, in spite of this horrific treatment that you underwent, you and the other women, Sylvia and
Alejandrina,
who was a Puerto Rican activist, you not only resisted, but you were able to really push back and create some very real positive conditions, some positive programs there. What did the three of you do to create a more humane environment in the conditions in which you were?
Well, we were together, which really was empowering in and of itself.
How was it that you were together but you couldn't be in?
We were locked together on a cell block. We were each in our own cell, but we were on this cell block that was 16 cells long that was in this basement. And so we could communicate with each other, which we did. And I think that the people on the outside really refused to allow us to be disappeared. And I think, certainly for myself, I can only speak for myself, but I always knew that there were people out there, and my family was very active in trying to shut that unit down. And I think we hung on, I certainly hung on to my political identity as a way to resist the decimation of my identity, which really was what those conditions were designed to do. And I think everybody there read a lot, and we talked about a lot of things, and it's where I first started to write and really kept a record of what was going on. My lawyer at the time, who was such an incredible fighter in the case, Mary O'Melveny, said to me, keep a record, write it down. You know, you have to be able to explain why you're calling this torture, what you think is happening. And that was a very important moment for me, and I took that advice to heart.
Susan Rosenberg. She was a leftist radical in the 1970s and 80s who was sentenced to 58 years in prison for possession of explosives. She'll tell us more about her story and about her life in federal prisons after the break. Her book is American Radical, A Political Prisoner in My Own Country. I'm Francesca Rhiannon, and you're listening to Writer's Voice. Don't go away.
I open up every door I can, 'cause all God's children ain't free. I met a beaten, broken man. He shovels dirt, but got no land, and he held out his hand to me. All God's children ain't free. I'd sing along to a silly song, but all God's children ain't free. I'm gonna sing a blues for the man they done wrong, 'cause all God's children ain't free. Mister, how about the man you condemned to die by taking everything that he's living by and reject him from society? All God's children ain't free, no. Reject him from society. All God's children ain't free.
That was Johnny Cash singing All God's Children Ain't Free on the album Johnny Cash's America. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with former American political prisoner Susan Rosenberg about her book, American Radical. Before the break, Rosenberg was telling us about the conditions in an experimental corrections unit in Lexington, Kentucky, where she was confined during the 1980s. The unit was closed down for being inhumane as a result of a lawsuit Rosenberg and other political prisoners brought against the U.S. Bureau of Prisons. The case was overturned on appeal, and the practices of the unit became the model for high-security supermax prisons around the country. When the Lexington unit was shut down, Rosenberg was sent to a maximum security federal prison in Danbury, Connecticut. There, she was put into the general population.
I went to Danbury after Lexington, and there it was the complete opposite, which was really very both difficult and wonderful in some ways. And I talk about this in the book, the first 10 years of my incarceration were spent in lockdown or maximum security or small group isolation or in the hole one way or another. And so That was doing time in one kind of way. And going to Danbury, I went into general population, where there were almost 2,000 women in one of the largest federal women's prisons in the United States. And I was closer to my family and to the community, and it afforded me a whole different set of conditions in which to live in doing time. And that's where I really became a writer and an advocate for other prisoners, and did a lot of peer advocacy around the HIV virus and other health issues for women inside. And really, I think there built community with people in a way that being in isolation, obviously, is impossible.
Yeah, and talk a little bit more about your work around HIV and AIDS. There's a very interesting discussion in your book, Susan Rosenberg, in American Radical. You have a certain perspective on the HIV-AIDS epidemic, women in prison, the drug war. Connect the dots for us.
Well, I think the drug war really was the vehicle through which thousands and thousands of women of color, particularly African-American women, went into prison. And they went into federal prison and local prisons, state prisons, in unprecedented numbers. And there were parallel epidemics that were going on, which were the war on drugs was an epidemic in a way, and there was the HIV virus. There was also a heightened use of crack at that time, which created a whole complex, terrible set of sentencing laws, much harsher laws that came down on women of color and poor women.
For example, you talk of one woman women who were incarcerated for decades who merely were the girlfriends of drug dealers.
Right. I mean, there's many examples of that. But the period that I'm writing about in this book is in the middle and late 80s and very early 90s. And at that time, people said women couldn't get HIV. I mean, this was at the beginning of the epidemic. And, you know, women were vectors for the disease. And so the treatment of women and the treatment of women in prison in general is just, you know, filled with contempt and oppression and real sexist, awful stuff. I mean, and I try and really explore that in the book. And it was very true around HIV and AIDS. And the thing that was very, I think, important was for me was that the Bureau of Prisons was mandated to do something about the HIV epidemic. This was before there was a cocktail, before there was a treatment. And so they sort of allowed us in a certain way, and we really organized to do it, to do peer advocacy and organizing and consciousness raising around the AIDS epidemic. And that was good work.
And what did being able to do that kind of work do for your own sense of yourself? I mean, here you had been sentenced to 58 years. There's a certain point in the book where it seems that your consciousness shifted. You know, kind of before that you were fighting your sentence, and after that you were engaged in this kind of productive work. Talk about that tectonic shift in yourself.
You know, the idea that I had to keep my heart open, and that I, you know, there's lots of ways to do time. And, you know, I realized after a couple of years inside that I was angry all the time, and that was not a way to live. And I didn't think that I was going to get out at any time soon, and I didn't know how I would get out. And so I think over a period, I really recognized that I needed to give back is not the right term, but to be of service. and to learn from the community that I was in, and to be a part of that community. And it really had a profound impact on me to sort of give up that anger. I think the other thing that happened in prison was that my ideology changed. My core values as a human being and some of my politics didn't change, but my ideology. I was in prison when the Soviet Union fell, when the Velvet Revolutions in Eastern Europe happened, when all of the national liberation movements that had been fighting for self-determination and independence laid down their arms and started to negotiate settlements. And so all the things that I had thought were going to happen in the world really took a different turn, and the United States won the Cold War. So that external series of events really forced me to think about my own internal politics and what I thought was going to happen and how. And that led to then a deeper examination of politics and violence and, you know, when and does the means justify the ends ever? And that whole conversation, which I had to really have with myself about what I had allowed myself to be associated with, to play a significant role in. And then I had to really go through taking responsibility for that, you know, for my own beliefs.
And what were your conclusions?
I mean, there's many conclusions. I mean, I think, you know, I tried the entire time I was inside to become a pacifist, because I thought and I think that pacifism is a beautiful and has worked as a mass strategy for social change. But I also did not stop believing that people who are oppressed have the right to resist. And that is still happening all over the world. What just happened in this spring is an example of people saying they're not going to let that foot stay on their neck. So it happens in different ways. But I mean, I think my view of armed struggle in the world as part of a national liberation strategy, as a strategy unto itself, that I really did reject that.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Susan Rosenberg about her powerful new book, American Radical, A Political Prisoner in My Own Country. While Rosenberg was incarcerated at the Federal Women's Prison in Danbury, Connecticut, something completely unexpected happened to her. You fell in love when you went to Danbury.
I did. I fell in love, which was an amazing experience. I'm not sure what to say about that.
Well, tell us about her.
I write about it in the book. I was very lucky to find a person who really helped me see the world in a different way, because she was a very creative person and very funny and had a lot of worldly experience. And we ended up in the same place at the same time and were able to, I think, really help each other.
So you have a kind of funny and yet still, you know, kind of horrific story in the book about how there was a clandestine operation at the prison, an enterprise by some of the women who were making dildos. Describe for us what the reaction of the prison authorities was, and why do you think they were so enraged?
Well, that's what they were. It was utter rage. I think, you know, people, the prison system is designed to dehumanize people. But you can't stop people from loving, no matter how much you try. And I think people inside, and particularly women inside, build relationships, they build sexual relationships, they build familial relationships, people have relationships from the outside that come into the prison. So there's a lot of women loving women and lesbianism that goes on in the prison, and you can't stop people from having sexual drives, you know. So the prisons in America have zero tolerance for everything. And the fact that a group of people could organize, being able to create these plastic dildos and take them out of the factory and sell them on the compound in the prison, it really infuriated them from every perspective. And I also think that there was a level of misogyny by the authorities toward women that really just came out in this. And it became the vehicle through which to do a witch hunt against women who were in relationships with other women and to put women in the hole because of that, to enforce a zero tolerance policy, no touching, just from every level of attacking women and in their personhood and in their sexuality. So it was an incredible story, and it showed, you know, to me, I didn't know that this was happening until I watched the people getting busted inside the prison for this. But it reinforced my feeling about the authorities when women deviate from whatever the roles, the prescribed roles that they're supposed to be in. The system really attacks them in a very deep and profound way. And so, you know, now, for example, there's an effort going on to stop prisons from shackling women who are giving birth inside prison hospitals. And, you know, there's litigation going on about that, and there's some laws, particularly in New York State, there's an effort to turn that into law, and there's been some success with that. But that's just an example of just the profound contempt and hatred.
Now, when you mentioned the woman that you fell in love with, how she opened you up to beauty and poetry and a whole different, you know, it's almost like a springtime comes to your life there. You also entered an MFA program in prison and began writing. Talk a little bit about becoming a writer.
Well, I think becoming a writer was really one of the most important things for me. And I wasn't a writer before I went to prison. And I started to write fiction after I was keeping a journal and writing poetry and reading a lot about writing. I wrote a short story that was a fictionalized version of something that had happened in the prison. And it won a Penn Award. Poets, essayists, and novelists have a prison writing committee as part of Penn, which I am a member of now, and work to propagate prisoners' writing and being able to send that writing out. That's a whole other thing. But so writing fiction allowed me to expand my own thinking and to play and to be a very different kind of thinker. And I think really that was critical for me. And when I did finally get to Population, I was able to go to school. I had to fight like crazy with the prison authorities. I was really shocked to find out when I finished that program that I was one of the first women in federal prison to get a master's because education has been eliminated. The Pell Grants that helped finance college-level education in federal prisons has been cut and never restored. So, and I was actually in prison the day that the Pell Grants were cut. And it was in 1994, and I remember because I was in Florida in a maximum security prison, and the Pell Grants were cut by Congress, and it was like 2% of the money that was going to federal programs inside prisons. And the prison authorities came and they locked the library. And that was the way that they announced that there would be no more any kind of higher education. And one other point about that is that it's really clear that the more education there is, the less recidivism there is, because people become invested in thinking and in changing.
So you were given a sentence of 58 years, but you got out after 16. How did that happen?
Well, that happened because of the people outside who supported me, who believed that I had been over-sentenced and that I was being kept in prison, denied parole, because of things that were in my record that I had never been tried for, and that was a violation of human rights and due process. And I had a lot of support and help. And there's a movement now to support political prisoners than there was when I was inside. And my parents and my family were really committed, and there were lawyers involved and parts of the political progressive movement. And I had been denied parole twice and was looking at doing another 15 years. And I realized that Bill Clinton was president at the time.
You were facing another 15 years before you could even ask for parole.
That's right. I had been given what is called a 15-year set-off. So President Clinton was in office, and I thought that President Clinton was probably going to be the one president in my lifetime who had an experience where I felt that he understood about being against the war in Vietnam, because he had been in the anti-war movement. And I thought that he would be somebody who, of course, would condemn everything that we had ever done, but who would have some understanding of who we were and who I was. And so I asked people on the outside to apply for clemency. And because of a lot of work that people did inside, outside, and in Congress, and on both sides of the aisle, and because of Gerald Nadler, who took my clemency petition to President Clinton, which was an amazing thing that he did.
Congressman Nadler.
Yes, Congressman Nadler, and Congressman of New York. He was my parents' congressman. That's how it happened.
And it went right down to the wire.
It was the last act that President Clinton did in office, was to sign that clemency paper. And it went right down to the wire, January 20th, 2001.
Wow. And so what are you doing now?
Well, I just spent a lot of time writing this book, which came out a couple of months ago. And
we should say we're talking with Susan Rosenberg, and the book is American Radical.
And that was a very important project to me. I felt very seriously I needed to write about the experience that I had been someone who, because of my being a political person and having my views and being able to use my resources to resist the dehumanization and the oppression of prison, and then to be privileged by my class and by being white and having come from a movement to actually get out of prison and make it to the other side, that I really have the responsibility to write about the experience. So I spent a lot of time doing that, and I'm really happy it's done.
And you have a job.
And I have a job, yes. I work as the director of communications at American Jewish World Service, where I've worked for a long time, a number of years, AJWS is a nonprofit organization, faith-based organization that does grant making to grassroots community-based organizations in the developing world that do work around health and gender and advocacy for human rights and a range of human rights-based work. And I've been very fortunate to have that job and have helped make AJWS what it is now.
And did they have any hesitation about hiring you?
Yes, they did, but at the end of the day, they were 100% there, and they were really very supportive of my writing the book and not being afraid that there would be a fallout and a backlash, and they've been great.
Well, the book is American Radical, Political Prisoner in My Own Country. Susan Rosenberg, I want to thank you for talking with us and also just tell you this is a very beautifully written book.
Thank you.
Susan Rosenberg. You can read an excerpt from American Radical at writersvoice.net. Wangari Maathai died on September 25th. She was a great inspiration to all those who care about peace, justice, and the environment. Maathai won the Nobel Peace Prize for her work in creating the Green Belt movement, engaging many thousands of poor women in Africa and elsewhere in planting millions of trees and thereby restoring the land and water of their regions. I spoke to Maathai in 2009 when she was in the U.S. to promote her book, The Challenge for Africa. Here's an excerpt from our interview where she talks about her approach.
Some of the major ideas that we have been trying to share for the last 30 years or so is to encourage all of us, the human species, to understand and to appreciate that we are part of nature, that we are not separate from it, and that when we destroy nature, we are in many ways undermining our own capacity to survive. So many of us think of nature as something to exploit, as if we can survive without it. And we then push it very far and get to the governance issues and say that it is very important for governments, for those who are in charge of our politics and our economics, to appreciate that we need to have political and economic systems that protect the environment, because a clean and healthy environment ensures that we too would be healthy. And the final linkage that we bring here is the idea that if we do not manage our resources in a responsible way, if we do not share these resources in a more equitable and just ways, sooner or later, we get ourselves into conflict with those who have been marginalized or excluded or deliberately made so poor that they begin to destroy the very environment that we all rely on. And therefore, it's very important to see the linkage between the way we manage our resources, the way we govern ourselves, and the way we link that with the possibility of living in peace or in conflict with each other and our neighbors.
Wangari Maathai died on September 25th at the age of 71. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Be sure to visit us at writersvoice.net to find out who's coming on next week, listen to archive shows, and leave your comments and suggestions. That's www.writersvoice.net. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.